Hello, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to another episode of the Daily Friend Show. I'm your host, Nicholas Lorimer, today joined by Marius Root. Marius, how are you doing?
I'm all right, and you?
I'm okay, thank you. I'm also joined today by Anlu Kieva. Anlu Kieva, sorry, I tripped over myself there, but Anlu, how are you doing?
We've had a few sunny days in Cape Town, so I'm feeling better. A lot better than during winters.
Yes, spring is definitely upon us, and while I am an anti-spring person, that is very, very uncommon, so I hope everyone else is enjoying the weather across South Africa. But let us get into the news of today, and there are two big stories today, but let's start off first, I think, with the important news from the presidency. So we've talked over the past couple of days about the threats to the government of national unity posed by the decision by President Ramaphosa to sign into law the Bela Bill. The Bela Bill is a major overhaul of South Africa's education system, which among some of the things in it are pretty uncontentious and good. Some of them are essentially taking away the power from school governing bodies, from local communities, from teachers, from parents, and placing them with the provincial departments. So the DA originally said that it was very upset that Ramaphosa had decided to sign the Bela Bill without agreeing to any amendments to it. He said that he was going to be signing it today. However, the DA did say that while they would take the Bela Bill to court, they would still implement it if they were forced to, and it was signed into law. They said they were not going to break the law. Well, President Ramaphosa initially seemed to sort of just brush off the DA's concerns, saying, well, you know, how dare they even talk about ending the GNU over this, and I don't think they will, and we're just going to go ahead and sign it. So it kind of looked like Ramaphosa was going to just sort of steamroll the DA through, but this morning he seems to have made a bit of a concession. President Ramaphosa has postponed the full implementation of the Bela Bill to allow for further engagements on two clauses, two of the most contentious clauses, over the next 3 months. Speaking at the signing of the bill, Ramaphosa said that he said the following, quote, "I am willing to allow those who believe in a solution, who believe a solution will be found to the two clauses they believe they have solutions for, to give them the opportunity and delay the implementation clauses 4 and 5 for a period of 3 months. The rest of the act is implemented immediately. This will give the parties time to deliberate in the spirit of cooperation and meaningful engagement. I cannot say no to engagement even at this late hour. I have to say, if you do believe these challenges can be resolved, I'm going to sign the bill to give a clear message to the people of SA that we are proceeding with the transformation of the education system. But as president, I am prepared to open a window for discussion in a limited period." However, he said that if no solution was found in 3 months, he was just going to implement the bill as written. The DA, I think, will be a little bit relieved by this. They seem to have gotten something. But Marius, what do you make of this? You know, who's this a win for? And do you think the DA is going to be able to change this legislation at all?
I think it was a test for the GNU. And I think that's probably a qualified pass. As some of the contentious issues have now obviously going to be re-looked at and so on. But Ryan Kutsia, who was a former DA strategist, I think he was also a DA MP about 20 years ago, and he's also part of the negotiation team now, part of the DA's negotiation team after the election to form the GNU. And he said on Twitter that the ANC is still acting as if it's a majority party and it can do what it likes. It has been, it's pushing through some quite contentious legislation. We obviously had the NHI bill signed into an act just before the election, before the GNU. But it seems that the ANC is still keen on pushing it in some ways. Aaron Motsoaledi, the health minister, seems definitely keen on it. And I think the Bela Bill, it was obviously something that the DA and the Freedom Front Plus both opposed before the election. And the fact that it has been signed now, I mean, it does get fairly it's a bit difficult because it was, I think it was passed before the election, and the president doesn't have that many, he can only send bills back on certain for certain reasons, you know. So he is a bit hamstrung if it's something's been passed by Parliament already. So I think it is a bit more complicated than the ANC just pushing this through. But I do think that's a lot of concerns of people in some parts in GNU have been ignored. And as I say, with other legislation as well, such as try and so on.
On that point of sending it back, the DA's complaints have specifically been that they believe the bill to be unconstitutional, which would be an acceptable reason for the president to send the bill back to Parliament if he wanted to. Morris, have you got anything more to add?
No, I was just agreeing with you.
Okay, sorry. We're seeing, I think the EFF is trying to kind of exploit the division within the GNU here. They put out a statement saying that the bill was voted for by Parliament and now it was the duty of President Ramaphosa to sign it into law. The EFF said, quote, "The bill introduces a suite of amendments to address systemic inequalities in basic education. Heads of department will be given the final authority to determine admission and language policies at school. School governing bodies are solely responsible for this, and this has enabled them to use the power to exclude African pupils and entrench racism at schools. This power has been used as a tool in the hands of white supremacists to isolate African languages and exclude African children for the attending state schools that were formerly exclusively white." Now, that's a claim that is, in most parts, kind of rubbish. Many of the schools that were formerly white are now majority black, and many of them are still, functioning just as before. The problem is that there's just so many dysfunctional schools that are not performing well, which is why people are so desperate to get into the ones that are functioning well. Also, as part of efforts of the DA to try and distance itself from this law, DA Basic Education Minister Siviwe Gorube said that she would not be attending the signing of the bill, which is unusual for a minister, that she'd be boycotting it because she did not believe in the legislation. And Lou, what do you make of all this? It seems that the DA is in a very precarious position here, where it's kind of doesn't want to burn the GNU down, but at the same time doesn't really want to acquiesce and look like they're just being pushed over. What are your thoughts on this?
If I can offer my two cents on just the process that it took to get where we are now. Initially, as you said earlier, also the DA said that they're going to leave the GNU if the Balabal is signed into law. And honestly, I think it's better for them to just stick with the GNU for now. It's something they've worked extremely hard to put in place, and it is showing some signs of signs that it is working. If there's an option for the law to be addressed or turned around, or any of their concerns at least to be addressed in court, why not just take that route instead of risking the whole coalition? I think right now the stability of the GNU should be our top priority. It really benefits the majority of South Africans. I'm not saying that the Balabal obviously won't have negative consequences, but if there's a way to challenge it legally, I think it's much preferred to risking the whole GNU. As for Minister Siviwe, shame. I'm a little bit on the fence, but I think it was a very tough position for her to be in, for any minister to be in. And it was a little bit awkward, I must admit, when President Ramaphosa greeted everyone and he didn't mention her name. So it was quite noticeable. But as for the signing of the bill, I think in the back of my mind, I initially saw it as if it would have been signed into law, I saw it as ANC 1, DA 0. But I think with Ramaphosa at least pausing the implementation of those two key clauses, I think it was 4 and 5, which was also obviously the most debated ones. It seems like there's at least still some room for dialogue. And it does show that cooperation in this sense is very possible, and that perhaps at least scorekeeping in that sense wouldn't have been the most healthy option for this type of situation. It's definitely encouraging to see that the door for dialogue is at least somewhat open, at least even if it's just for a limited time. Whether we'll see any real changes, I really don't know. I think what is clear at this stage is at least that it depends on the discussions they'll have in the next 3 months. The bill definitely introduces big adjustments, so I think it's important that we just stay informed of how it can affect the communities, parents and their children in the schools. Yeah, and I think the fact that the president decided to at least delay the implementation shows a chance to address some of these concerns. I think the minister is at least in a somewhat easier position now afterwards than she would have been if it was signed into law without any without delaying those two clauses. The delay, I think, to some extent, at least shows that her voice carries weight. And I think it'll give her and the party, to some extent, a little bit more confidence that they can influence the outcome.
So, Maurice, we're seeing this sort of increasing pattern kind of evolving across a lot of government, which is that, you know, it's almost as if the sort of each ministry is kind of like its own island, and you're getting these bizarre things where, you know, the DA is basically considering, in this case, implementing a bill and at the very same time challenging it in court to try and prevent it from being implemented. You're seeing sort of opposition parties, or former opposition parties rather, attacking the GNU in some departments and in other departments kind of cozying up to government. It's sort of a very bizarre space, but I think one of the things that might be positive about it is there's now far more focus on policy than there has been up to now. What do you make of all this?
Yeah, and it's going to be one of those contradictions we get having a coalition government. And the DA is going to have to perhaps get on board with some things it's not a fan of. But then at the same time, having the DA and parties like the Freedom Front Plus, et cetera, in government, I think it's quite good for policy. There'll be actually policy debates. The ANC won't be able to just ram things through as it's been used to in the past. It's going to have to make some concessions. And I think in a lot of ways, the ANC hasn't, as I mentioned earlier with what Duane Couture was saying, the ANC hasn't come to terms with the fact that it's not it's not a majority party in South Africa anymore. It can't just do anything at once, and it's got to make concessions to other political parties. And I think that's good for South Africa. I think it's definitely, we'll see more debates around policy. The ANC, we're sort of out of the ANC universe now. Not everything in South African politics revolves around the ANC anymore. And I think that can only be good for the country, I think.
So let's move on to our next story. And this is probably the biggest story in the country today. And that is that former minister, former SARS commissioner, very big figure, I think, on our political stage over the last couple of decades, Pravin Gordhan, has passed away at the age of 75. He apparently was admitted to hospital a few days ago. He had a short battle with cancer, which took his life. He was surrounded by his family and friends when he died, and his sort of final statement put out by his family was, no regrets, we have made our contribution. He survived by his wife and his two daughters. Now, Pravin Gordhan is a character who I think is being praised very heavily in many of the obituaries and reporting of him today. There's definitely, you know, he had a long record in government and he did a lot of things. He was, as I said, the first commissioner of SARS in 1998 when it was established, and he got a lot of credit for building up that institution to be successful. He was then placed as Zuma's first finance minister in 2009. At which point I think his record begins to get a lot darker. He reversed many of the prudent and, you know, sort of fairly restrained spending practices of the Trevor Manuel era and the Mbeki era, which had come before, and began the blowing out of South Africa's debt, which has sort of continued to this day. He was removed as finance minister in 2014 and moved to the Department of Cooperative Governance and Traditional Affairs. He was replaced by Nhlanhla Nene, who was then later, after he refused to sign the controversial nuclear deal, at Zuma's insistence, was replaced by the so-called weekend special. The finance minister was only around for a couple of days, Des van Rooyen, and then Pravin Gordhan was brought back in after Des van Rooyen was removed due to a freak out from the markets. Pravin Gordhan got a lot of credit in the media in particular for having defended the country from the influence of Zuma and the Guptas who were never fully able to get total control over the finance and treasury departments in the South African government. Under his watch, SARS kind of collapsed when a sort of pro-Zuma commissioner was placed in during the sort of second half of the Zuma administration. After the end of Zuma's time in government, he was placed in charge of public enterprises, where I think he probably did some of his worst work. As far as I understand, Minister Gordhan was a bit of a micromanager. He was also quite an ideologue. And I think that he made a lot of negative contributions to both the SAA projects. SAA should have been sold or shut down, but he was so insistent on keeping it alive. I also think he interfered far too much in the appointment and hiring policies of Eskom, and I think that definitely contributed to load shedding. So a bit of a mixed record. I think that, unfortunately, he was probably a bit overrated in the public eye in the sort of mainstream. I think he definitely did some good and impressive things in his career, but I also think that, by and large, he made many decisions that did not help the country in the towards prosperity. Maurice, am I being unfair? What do you make of the life and career of Pravin Gordhan post 1994?
I don't think you're being unfair. He's like all human beings. He's complex. And there's positive things to say about him and negative things. As you say, he was a bulwark against the worst excesses of the state capture years. He stood up against Jacob Zuma and the Guptas and so on. But when he was finance minister, he definitely didn't keep a handle on South Africa's finances. There's a chart I saw a little while ago showing South Africa's debt. And it just goes, it spirals basically out of control from about 2009 when Gordhan became finance minister. And I mean, he was obviously a pretty good technocrat. He ran SARS pretty well. But I do think he was an ideologue. And he was, I don't think it's unfair to call him a communist. And as you say, I think that blinded him to some of the ways that South Africa could have been run better, especially with, as I said, things with public enterprises and SAA and all that kind of thing. He blocked a lot of reforms that I think could have seen things improving in a lot of our state enterprises. So overall, I think it's definitely, I think it's important to mourn him. As I say, I think he probably was a good person. There's never any kind of allegations of corruption or anything against Pravin Gordhan. I think he had the best interests of the country at heart, but I do think his ideology failed him. And I think as I say, no, all human beings are complex. And while I think Gordhan was a good person, I do think it was his ideology that is what really tarnishes his legacy, I think.
So, Anlu, your thoughts on this? I will also remark, and there's been a bit of mention of this in some of the reporting as well, so just how much, particularly in the later years of his career, how much racist language and racist attacks were used against him, particularly by the EFF, who sort of called him nicknames and sort of just kind of tried to demean him in Parliament and in all sorts of ways. And that, you know, is, of course, completely unacceptable, and he should never have had to go through all of that. But what do you make of the career of Mr. Gordhan, Minister Gordhan?
Well, I think his passing this morning is definitely something that we should pause and reflect on. He was a big figure, whether it was overrated or not. I think he took on some tough challenges. And many of the roles that he undertook was extremely difficult. And as we've said, it earned him both praise and criticism. People had a lot to say about his, not had, have a lot to say about his time in office and the policies that he implemented, both which are good and bad. But I think what we can't deny is the fact that he had a very long-standing commitment to the country. And at the end of the day, whether he put the state or his party first, he definitely left his mark on the country. Our thoughts are with his family and his loved ones.
Definitely. I think that is an important point to make, is that he was actually a very big part of the direction that South Africa, I think, has taken, particularly since 2009. But, you know, also prior, SARS is a key institution. The finance ministry is a key institution. The public enterprises stuff has also been a key department in government over the last couple of years. You look at all these departments and you look at what Pravin Gordhan has done in them, and I think it's very difficult to come to the conclusion that he ultimately did more good than harm, unfortunately, to a lot of South Africans' situations. And I mean, you know, good on him for standing up to Zuma, but, you know, he still continued to support and enable the party that gave us Jacob Zuma in the first place, which is, you know, so yes, things could have been worse, and he definitely did some things that required some real courage. In preventing, you know, he could have lost his job. He could have been, I'm sure there were probably threats against his life at various points. He was dragged through the mud, demeaned, called a racist, called like a foreigner, just sort of dragged down. Maurice, any final thoughts before we move on?
Yeah, I think there's lots of things you can criticize Pravin Gordhan for, but a lot of the criticism has focused on his race and so on, which is obviously, I mean, there was the fashion for a while to call him Jamnadas, I think it was, which was his middle name, which obviously is a very, is quite Indian sounding. And yeah, it was something that was happening. I think that was quite disgraceful. And today there was, I mean, the EFF released a statement, saying all kinds of rubbish about, I didn't disagree with the whole statement, but the tone of it was really not great. And I saw it on Twitter, and then somebody shared a clip of Julius Malema saying, all South Africans should stand with Pravin Gordhan. He's a hero for standing up to Jacob Zuma. So I just also think it shows the EFF flip-floppers, which we all know they are.
Yes, the EFF who once, of course, were willing to die for Zuma and then were anti-Zuma and now, I guess, are maybe sort of willing to die from him. It's not entirely clear at the moment. Anyway, let's go on to our last story. And this is another one of these little stories that I think is a bit of an example for the situation of the country as a whole. There was a raid carried out in Westbury in Johannesburg, in El Dorado Park in Johannesburg over the last couple of days by the Johannesburg Metropolitan Police and the South African Police Service. And this was targeting drug gangs, drug dealers, people like that. During the operation, 10 suspected drug dealers were arrested, and undercover officers had previously identified drug dens, and then the sort of forces moved in to arrest people. During this operation, though, the MMC for Public Safety, who I'm not actually sure. I think he's an EFF member. I'll need to go and double check that. But anyway, he gave a speech where he said that JMPD officers have to shoot to kill when criminals fired on them. He then also said, "We are not going anywhere until we win this battle. Recently, some gang members were brazenly shooting everywhere, daring us that they are untouchable. We are here and they have run away. We have invited them to come and meet us and they didn't. The cowards have run away. We are not going to watch them shoot at the communities. We are going to be here daily for 4 months." Now, you know, these gangs, particularly in places like Westbury and El Dorado Park, are a real menace. There are killings all the time. You know, almost every month there are at least a couple of killings where these rival gangs fighting each other. Drugs have completely ravaged those communities around them. This is a very serious issue, not just in Joburg, of course, but also in other parts of the country, particularly the Western Cape. And so, I understand when politicians want to talk big, and we've seen this so many times in South Africa's history. I think Fikile Mbalula said that police must crush the balls of criminals, and that they must, that we must shoot to kill. I can't remember which police minister said that, but another famous comment from them. But this always sort of misses the point, which is the problem with our criminal justice system is how the cops have low morale, have been infiltrated by criminal gangs themselves, are susceptible to corruption, have relatively little or bad quality training, and just aren't equipped with the resources they need to do their job properly. And so the sort of easy, quick fix to this seems to be to politicians to say, you must just be more aggressive then. Unfortunately, Maurice, we've seen the negative consequences of the police sometimes going way overboard And until you fix these basic problems with the structure of the police service, you can tell the police to just machine gun down everyone they suspect. And I mean, apart from the morality of that decision, it's not actually going to fix crime. What do you make of this?
Yeah, I think that's exactly it. I mean, the police do need to have the tools to fight crime, but I don't think it's ideal for the police to be, you know, shooting dead criminals all the time. And our police are actually more murderous than the Brazilian or the American police, which is something that if you look at a per capita basis, how many people are killed by the police or die in police custody and so on, which is often something I think is overlooked. I mean, you obviously have to have a lot of sympathy for the police. I mean, it's a very hard job. And as you say, they often don't have the tools to fight, to equip themselves properly for the fight against crime. As you say, there's low morale and so on. They're infiltrated by criminal elements. So I think it's a very hard job. But I also don't think we want to be, we don't want police that are trigger happy. I mean, you obviously have to get the balance, but I think this also links back to overall kind of decay in South Africa. Our murder rate on a per capita basis was declining since the mid-1990s. And then we got to 2009, 2010, and we all know what happened that year. And our murder rate's been climbing again. And I think I'm open to correction. I don't think it's ever got as bad as it hasn't got to the levels it was in the mid-1990s. But I think it's getting close to there. And every year, our murder rate is growing. And it's obviously because of quite a few complex reasons, but it's partly because of the hollowing out of South African institutions, breaking down of things like crime intelligence and so on. And that all links to this. And now that's why we're seeing an increased murder rate, that means the politicians are trying to be seen as doing something. So they say these silly things like shoot to kill. I think it was Becky Cele who said that, actually. You know, and all this kind of stuff. So it's not ideal, but also, yeah, the police have a very difficult job. And I don't know what the solution is, but yeah, it's a complex issue. And yeah, as I said, I don't think it's helped by politicians, you know, saying basically police should be blowing away anybody who's, you know, speeding or jaywalking or something.
Anlu, you know, what do you make of this? I did double check the councillor who made these comments, Councillor Shwaku, is from the EFF. This to me smacks of what we might call, soundbite politics. Sounds good, but it's not really accompanied by anything that's going to make a real difference in people's lives.
Well, I think from what Marius just mentioned, the murder rate, it's so obvious that things has gotten really bad, especially in places like our example today, Eldorado Park and Westbury, was it? So I, to some extent, understand the frustration, and it makes sense that the community is also wanting the police force and in this situation, the Johannesburg Metro Police, I think, to go into the communities. People want to feel safe in their homes, in their streets. So I, to some extent, feel that the fact that the officers are ready to protect themselves and the public shows that they're at least serious about getting things under control. Whether this is just some pressure from the top down to be a little bit more aggressive, that I can't say. But although I realize it's important to put a stop to gang violence, and specifically in this sense, gang violence, going in too aggressive can definitely cause more harm than good. Mistakes in the heat of the moment, as you also mentioned, targeting the wrong people, using too much force, it damages the trust between the community and also the police force. So it's important that we find that kind of balance. And it's about running smart and careful operations that keeps everyone safe without overstepping. And I realize we're talking about violent gangs here, but I definitely think in the long run, it's better to be accountable and in a sense, avoid missteps, which we can do through better training of the police force, better resources and equipment and those type of things. And I think this is what builds a safer community without adding a whole lot of new problems. Yeah.
Any final thoughts, Marius?
No, but I think fixing the police is one of the things it's something that we really have to get right, because I think for a lot of people, or you know, for South Africa as a whole, the two things that you really have to get fixed, I think, is unemployment and safety. And I think I'm open to correction here, but I think we are, on a per capita basis, the fourth most dangerous country in the world. And we're easily the biggest, most dangerous, like any country that's got more than, say, 10 million people, we're by far the most dangerous. So we're actually worse than Brazil now, I think. So, and I think those are the two big things in South Africa, unemployment and poverty is linked to that, obviously, and then the issues of safety. And as with most of these things, the people who suffer most from it are poorer South Africans. If you look at the murder rates, you know, Cape Town is actually a more dangerous city than Johannesburg. But if you walk through the city bowl, you're going to be fine. But that's not where you are likely to get murdered. It's on the Cape Flats and in Langa and all those kinds of places. So, yeah, those are two things. I mean, I think fixing the police and just issues of unemployment are probably the two things we really have to focus on as a country.
Indeed. Okay, that's all the time we have for today. We hope you found the show interesting. And I hope you all have a wonderful weekend. We'll see you all next week. Cheers.